Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. We design, craft and install beautiful kitchens. cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Well, so far this summer, there has been much speculation about potential presidential candidates and the positioning of the various political parties around all of this in advance of the election, which is likely to be held in October. But what about the history of the office? Why does it exist in the first place? What's its significance? What issues and controversies have been associated with it since its creation back in the 1930s? Well, joining me now to put it all into perspective is Diarmaid Ferriter, Professor of Modern Irish History at UCD. Hello, Diarmaid.
Morning, Claire.
Good to have you with us. Now, this is a timely conversation, isn't it, with the headlines dominated as they have been with potential candidates, as we say. Will we start with that question that we pose about why the thing exists in the first place?
Yeah, I think we need to remind ourselves every 7 or 14 years why the office was created in 1937 under the new constitution. And it really was created because there was a determination on the part of anti-treaty republicans who won power in 1932 to get rid of the political architecture of imperialism in Ireland. You know, historically there had been a Lord Lieutenant or a Viceroy as a representative of the Crown in Ireland. And then with the signing of the Anglo-Irish Treaty, there was the office of Governor General to represent the Crown in Ireland. Very controversial. And there were related controversies around the Oath of Allegiance and those continuing connections with the Crown and the Commonwealth. So creating the office of President was really about making that break, that you would have in this constitution the institutions of a republic. It was a constitution for a republic in all but name. It wasn't named a republic because Ireland remained partitioned and because there were still solid reasons for maintaining a certain link with the Commonwealth, given the delicate balance of Anglo-Irish relations and the future prospects for unity. But there was a determination to get rid of any external involvement in internal Irish affairs. So you had the creation of this republican institution, the office of the president. And it was controversial from the outset when it was being proposed. There were heated and quite vigorous stall debates in the summer of 1937 about what this office might mean.
Well, what were the worries about it, the concerns?
Well, the worries were, given the climate of the 1930s, some of the political opponents of De Valera, including the media, the Irish Independent, for example, suggested that with the creation of this office, they were sowing the seeds of Nazi-like dictatorship powers. Because there was a controversial draft of an article relating to the presidency that additional powers and functions may be conferred on the president by law. And that was zoned in on. It was subsequently amended to on the advice of the government. And De Valera responded by saying the role of the president would largely be about signing into law decisions that had been made by other people.
Yeah.
He even used the phrase hurler on the ditch, that a president would not be on the pitch, but that they would, in a sense, you know, be observing and ensuring propriety and would be above politics. And the way he put it, it would not be appropriate. A president has to be interested in politics, he acknowledged, but it would not be appropriate for a president to speak contrary to the views of the government. Though he did acknowledge that you couldn't take away from a president their political views. So this was being debated in the Dáil in 1937, in the summer of 1937, before the constitution was put to the people. But it's also crucially about sovereignty. It's about the sovereignty of the people and a directly elected president or agreed president who will represent that sovereignty of the Irish people at home and abroad. And it was envisaged as a largely ceremonial office. There's no doubt about that.
Well, was the job neutered then to solve the row?
No, what they did was they specified particular functions that the president would have. You know, and we'd be familiar with them in terms of summoning or dissolving the Dáil on the advice of the government, seals of office, that they could also have a council of state and could, on the advice of that council of state, address the members of the Oireachtas on matters of national importance. But again, it was not envisaged that this would be what we now understand, I suppose, in modern parlance, to be an active presidency. So when you talk about neutering, we should, I think, banish the idea that all the presidents prior to 1990 were asleep. Our retirees.
Well, there is that notion around the place that,
there is,
that it was a bit of a
and I think it's unfair,
right?
Because the real challenge in 1938, Douglas Hyde is the first president. He's not elected. He's an agreed candidate. He was 78. He was very old. That was very old in 1938. And of course, he has a special place in the history of the Irish language movement, the Gaelic League and so on. He was also a Protestant, which was very useful in relation to stressing the idea that this Southern Ireland would be a religiously tolerant place, even though it was overwhelmingly Catholic. But one of the issues that emerges in relation to Douglas Hyde is just how this presidency will be managed. What will the relationship with the state and the government, how will that be managed? Michael McDonoghue was the secretary to the first President Douglas Hyde, and he vigorously protected the integrity and the credibility of the office. He wanted direct access to the Taoiseach. He wanted respect for the office. Michael McDonoghue was also busier because Douglas Hyde had a stroke in 1940, 2 years after he became president, and he was largely incapacitated. So there were those issues there. But he did establish that credibility and respect for the office. That was not without difficulties. And what you'll often find in going to the archives, there was an awful lot going on behind the scenes that, of course, wouldn't necessarily have been public knowledge. And there's also then all the, not just the ceremonial duties, but the prize givings, the endorsing of charities, the conveying of commiserations and congratulations and so on. But it was about establishing that at the outset from 1938 to 1945. Mm-hmm. And then you had an established Fianna Fáil politician elected,
Sean T. O'Kelly
in 1945. And Sean T. was a 1916 veteran. He was in the GPO. He was a very devout Catholic. He had been quite tribal, but to his credit, he actually used the office to stress the need for reconciliation between both sides of the Civil War. And he also took the presidency abroad. You know, I mean, that culminated in addressing the joint houses of Congress in America, which is very high profile. So there was an opportunity to spread the wings of the president. But he was also regarded as politically very safe. And of course, he was very close to De Valera as well. Uh-huh. And they had to endeavour to keep him away from the drinks cabinet because it was well known that he had a fondness for whiskey. And again, these are the things that, you know, that emerge over time, some of the delicacies around the characters and the temperaments and the personalities. But he was much more gregarious. You know, Hyde was quite unforthcoming. His favourite pastime was shooting game. So, you know, you have that bedded down, I suppose, right up to 1959.
So then we come to De Valera, De Valera's time. So tell us about that. That was 59 to 73.
Well, there was a determination on the part of the opposition that De Valera would not get a clear run at the park. And, you know, that ultimately culminated for the second term in an election where, for political anoraks, the key figure is 10,617 votes. That was the margin between himself and Tom O'Higgins in 1966, the time of the 50th anniversary of the Easter Rising. And it could have been a humiliation. But De Valera, of course, again, was a very aged man when he went in to the presidency and was there for 14 years. And it was low key, you know, that sense of the presidency as an anchor. He's there as a symbol. He's a very respected elder statesman at home and abroad, even though there's a very significant proportion of the people who don't like him at all. But interestingly, there's a very strong rural-urban divide emerged in that election in 1966. Tom O'Higgins was younger and he used his wife, Terry Keane, a lot in the campaign. The idea of Tom and Terry in the park, a new brush that would sweep away the De Valera cobwebs. And he very nearly made it. But that was obviously something that Fianna Fáil weren't mindful of, that they couldn't take it for granted.
Yeah, interesting times, I would imagine, you know, that challenge to De Valera, who made it clear that he wanted a second term. To go up against him was a brave thing to do, right?
It was, and he very nearly pulled it off, you know. But there was always concern about the dignity of the office. You know, I was very amused to find a document relating to a proposal in 1972 from Muhammad Ali, of all people, himself. He wanted to visit the president. He was in town to fight Al Lewis in Croke Park, you know, that famous fight.
Yes.
And he wanted to visit the president, and the president's staff were having none of it. They said it would not be appropriate for the president to be greeting a boastful and bombastic man like Muhammad Ali. And it brings you back to this idea of the decorum and the dignity around the office. But again, there were always tensions behind the scenes in relation to whether or not a president might refer a piece of legislation to the Supreme Court. But again, these are issues that really begin to gather controversy and explode in the 70s.
I'm wondering, did De Valera want to meet Muhammad Ali? He obviously didn't get a say in it, right? They never told him that Ali wants to come.
Well, I mean, what's interesting about looking at De Valera and his presidency is just how modest the diaries were. And they were also very conscious of his age and his failing sight and what it was feasible for him to do.
They went easy
but
on.
Also the unpredictability. I think this is the important point about the presidency and how it's changed. They wanted predictability. If you have a character like Ali coming up to the park, you have no idea what he's going to say.
No,
but
that's
you know,
the crack of it, right?
You know he's very likely. But you see, they weren't in
they weren't
to the
crack.
Presidential crack now in the 1950s and the 1960s.
Now, Erskine Childers then from 73... And he felt like a prisoner in the park.
Yeah, I interviewed Nessa Childers, his daughter, who of course went on to become a politician herself. And she described him in those terms. And I knew that from the archives because he was being censored. He was not allowed to convene the think tanks that he had made a part of his campaign. There was a very vigorous censorship of his speeches. You know, and they were going through them in the Department of Taoiseach line by line saying, that's not appropriate for a president. Like at one stage, he had a line in a speech saying that living was excessively frugal for a proportion of the population.
Yeah.
Lying through it. Not appropriate for a president to refer to that. That kind of censorship. Mm-hmm. And he was also, again, and the tribalism comes into it here, he felt he wasn't being respected by the Fine Gael-led government from 1973 to 1977. But of course, he died in office before the end of that term. So he was very frustrated. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, you can understand if everything was being censored in that way. And we think about how much it has changed now.
And he was also, you see, you know, Childers was a very interesting and sometimes quite unpredictable character. So there may have been a degree of concern about that as well. And of course, when he died in office then, there was a dilemma about what to do. And you had the agreement then of a replacement for him, and that was Carúl O'Dolig.
Right, not an election, an agreement.
No, and that bothered Carúl O'Dolig. His papers are in UCD, and he made the point in some of his private notes that, you know, I was a substitute for an elected president. I did not seek this office, and I will only hold it as long as I can retain it with dignity.
Uh-huh. Which takes us to 1976.
And that's why he resigned. Because he was insulted, egregiously insulted by the Minister for Defence, Patrick Donegan, who called him a thundering disgrace for referring the Emergency Powers Bill to the Supreme Court. And again, the fervid atmosphere there around the Troubles and the idea of giving the Gardaí more power to deal with subversives and civil liberties questions very much generating political heat and controversy. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, Liam Cosgrave as head of government handled matters very poorly. He should have ensured the resignation of Donegan, but he didn't. But what was also interesting, and again, it comes back to a constitutional obligation on the head of government to keep the president generally informed of matters of state and matters of government. And O'Dolig made the point that Cosgrave never did that. Mm-hmm. In his infrequent visits, he didn't even remotely keep me informed of that business.
Doesn't it feel very quaint now to have to resign on the head of being called a thundering disgrace? You'd have to be called a lot worse now, wouldn't you?
Yeah, but again, he was talking about the dignity of the office, and that was an egregious insult, especially to the head of state. That person, the head of state, takes precedence over all other people in the state. So he was also, of course, you know, officially commander of the defence forces. So, and you know, you have to think about O'Dolig and his legal background as well. He was a very cerebral man as well, and a very...
But retrospectively, he shouldn't have been the one who had to go, right?
Oh, there's
no
doubt about that.
No doubt about that.
And there was widespread anger about that. But then Patrick Hillary goes into that position, again, not seeking it. He's an agreed candidate within 2 weeks. He's had this sterling career as a Fianna Fáil minister, as an EU commissioner. And there he is. And he ends up, he did reputedly say, I'm going into a vacuum that's hard to explain. And there was a sense that he had to restore the calm. You know, that again, the anchor, go back to the idea of the anchor. And he did say he was going to do the job with the minimum of self-projection.
All right, so deliberately holding back.
Yeah, but
in
he
that
also
office.
Complained that the office was underfunded and that his activities were underreported. That, you know, and there was an element of truth in that as well. Mm-hmm. But I certainly don't think he ever envisaged himself as president, and certainly not for 14 years. But it suited the governments of the day.
So then we're up to 1990 when everything changes about this office. Fair to say?
Yeah, it is. And I mean, I was a student journalist in UCD at the time of that. I was 18 years old, 17 or 18. And I asked Ronan Fanning, who was my history tutor, he was the professor of modern history then, about Mary Robinson, because, you know, this was creating quite a degree of publicity and dynamism and even excitement about the idea that there was going to be a race and that there was somebody proposing an act of presidency, a different kind of presidency. And I said, what do you think of Mary Robinson's proposals? And he quite huffily said, what's the point in running for an office that doesn't exist? Mm-hmm. And it was actually a fair question, Because Mary Robinson was proposing something different. Now, as a lawyer, she was making the point that she was aware of the modest parameters of the office, but that she thought there was scope within those modest parameters to do something different. So that was the quite haughty response I got from Ronan Fanning. But as a historian, he was making a legitimate point about what had been envisaged.
Well, who was right in that respect?
Well, this is the interesting thing about the long-term consequences of the office, of what it can be and what some believe it cannot be. There's still debate about that to this day. We often refer to lines not being crossed. Aside from the specific functions that are specified, there's nothing in the Constitution to say that a president cannot speak their mind. Mm-hmm. Some of those lines that are often talked about are actually invisible lines. And then there are very specific functions that they need to perform on the advice of the government. But Mary Robinson was making the point about what she could do symbolically and who she could meet and who she could greet and how she would talk about the narratives of each other's diversities and this new kind of tone that's about inclusiveness, but also being much more visible and championing particular causes that may historically have been regarded as beyond the remit of the president. But there were always controversies. And again, we'd be familiar with some of the controversies associated with Mary Robinson being prevented from doing certain things and then going ahead and doing certain things, mm-hmm. shaking the hand of Gerry Adams, for example. So you have that. And then Mary McAleese obviously crafting a particular narrative around the peace process and responding to the politics of the day. But again, placing herself above the warring parties as a symbol of reconciliation. And of course, that ultimately culminated in the Queen visiting in 2011. Yes. So in a sense, it was a very, very successful project. But again, the question was, could it go further? And Michael D. Higgins insisted he could take it further. And the way he put it was, I'm not going to stop being Michael D. because I've been elected president. People have elected a president. They haven't elected a puppet. If they want a puppet, they can elect a puppet. People knew the causes he was associated with. This is the argument that he was making. But again, does that also involve a tolerance of very public criticisms and very critical remarks in relation to policy areas, whether yes. that's, you know, the EU or taxation or housing and so on? And, you know, you might recall PJ Mara, who famously said about the internal heaves against his leader, Charles Haughey, in Fianna Fáil, there'll be no more nibbling at my leader's bum.
Yeah.
You know, there was a sense sometimes, sorry for these unsavoury images, mm-hmm. that the president was actually biting the government's bum. But that was tolerated. There's an awareness, of course, of how popular he is. But also a determination maybe not to allow a controversy to ignite. Future governments may well decide that benign, they don't want to do that.
But that benign relationship, you can't rely on that, you know, on the tolerance and...
No, and that can change.
They're not having a children's situation.
Yeah. And there may well be a changed appetite around tolerance of those kind of interventions. But you also have a strong sense now that the style and the tone have changed. The mm-hmm. constitutional provisions
haven't changed.
But the style and the tone have. And people like that, perhaps, because you also have the soulfulness then and that sense of symbolism. And in Michael D. Higgins's case, you have the cerebral element and the convening of seminars and, you know, addressing philosophical issues even. So there's a real wide range there. And the question, of course, I suppose, that's going to be there during this campaign is whether that can continue. Or would some people like to put brakes on that, have the limits in that sense?
Redraw the boundaries. Dermot, we'll leave it there. That was fascinating. Thank you so much. Dermot Farriter, we'll take a break.
Get in touch on WhatsApp 0870 32 32 32.